Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the election gains made by the British Labour Party, which ran on a strong progressive platform. John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the future of the U.S. progressive movement after attending the People's Summit conference in Chicago. And Lee Stewart of the group Beyond Extreme Energy, who talks about an ongoing campaign demanding that no new federal energy regulatory commissioners be confirmed by the U.S. Senate until an ethics investigation is conducted. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Guatemalan mother Josefina Nieto fled Central America with her son after surviving years of sexual and emotional abuse from her husband, whom she married as a teenager. Nieto, who fled for safe haven in Mexico, joins a growing wave of women migrants heading north to Mexico to escape poverty and violence. On the border with Mexico and Central America, one in four migrants detained by Border Patrol agents last year were female, compared to only one in seven in 2011. Asylum applications in Mexico have soared 150% since Donald Trump's election in November 2016. Mexico is an attractive destination for women fleeing domestic abuse because that country's refugee law classifies gender violence as a legitimate reason for seeking asylum. The law covers victims of sexual trafficking, child marriage, and domestic violence. Yet some advocates complain Mexico's refugee agency, COMAR, is slow in protecting victims of domestic and sexual abuse. Meanwhile, the United Nations continues to criticize many Latin American nations for systemic indifference to domestic abuse crimes. Local officials in Arizona and Utah are ramping up pressure on the Trump administration to roll back Obama-era regulations that blocked uranium mining near the Grand Canyon. In 2012, the Obama administration imposed a 20-year ban on uranium mining on sites adjacent to the Grand Canyon, declaring that such mines would raise the risk of contamination of water flowing through the canyon. Past uranium mining operations in northern Arizona left hundreds of polluted sites on Navajo land, leading to cases of cancer and kidney failure. The National Mining Association and other commercial interests launched a legal challenge to the ban, and a ruling from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is expected soon. The Mojave County Board of Supervisors, which represents the northern rim of the canyon, is also seeking to overturn the mining ban in an appeal to President Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, who has already canceled a moratorium on coal leases and has pledged to open up public lands to greater oil and gas extraction. In instituting the ban in 2012, the Obama administration says it was protecting millions of visitors to the Grand Canyon, local Native American communities, and millions of people who rely on water from the Colorado River. The city of Huntington, an epicenter of the opioid epidemic in West Virginia, is the first community in the state to establish a dedicated team to respond to opioid overdose calls. Huntington's fire department responds to at least five overdose calls a day. In 2016, the New York Times reported that 59,000 people died of drug overdoses. Between 2000 and 2015, opioid overdoses killed more than 500,000 Americans, equivalent to the number of Americans killed by guns. At the same time, Americans consume 80% of the global supply of opioids. According to the Christian Science Monitor, one person dies from a drug overdose on average every 10 hours in West Virginia. The shocking number of deaths is driven by people suffering from chronic pain, a low level of education, and large quantities of painkillers flooding the state promoted by unscrupulous drug wholesalers. Activist attorneys in West Virginia charged that opioid manufacturers launched a campaign in their state to increase the sale and use of opiate drugs. In the past 5 years, over 780 million doses of hydrocodone and oxycodone were shipped to West Virginia. State Representative Justin Markham is leading a lawsuit against the biggest drug distributors, Cardinal Health, McKesson, and AmerisourceBergen. In January, West Virginia won a $36 million settlement from two of the three largest drug manufacturers, resulting from a lawsuit filed in 2012. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
When conservative British Prime Minister Theresa May called a snap election for June 8th, she was hoping to increase her party's power in Parliament as the country began Brexit negotiations on terms for leaving the European Union. However, voters had a different plan. Instead of strengthening her standing, the Prime Minister lost seats, with no party now having a majority, what's called a hung Parliament. May's ruling Conservative Party won 318 seats, 8 seats short of a majority, forcing her to forge a coalition government with Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP. The DUP, which won 10 seats, holds controversial policy views, including opposition to same-sex marriage and abortion, climate change denial, and rejection of the theory of evolution. Just weeks ago, Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn was written off by media pundits who predicted that Labour would suffer a historic defeat. But under the banner of For the Many, Not the Few, Corbyn promoted a party manifesto that included strengthening workers' rights, nationalization of key industries, increased taxes on the wealthy, and free childcare. His party won 262 seats, an increase of 30 since the last election. Your reporter spoke with Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the Labour Party's platform that helped them defy expectations and dramatically improve their position in Parliament.
Well, you know, the pundits were not so off a few weeks ago, on May 18th, when the most recently successful pollster had Tories winning a large majority. It's just they lost that lead in the last few weeks. And, in fact, May 18th was the day that Labour came out with the Labour Manifesto. And that was the first thing that kind of broke through because it showed people, it got in the media, and instead of all the bad things that they would say personally about Corbyn being the news about the Labour Party and Corbyn, it was now what did they stand for. It was a little more in the news. And I think maybe the pundits didn't realize that people would actually like this program because it was a pretty left program. And so maybe that's why they reported it. But it turned out people liked it quite a bit. They were calling for major increases in spending on the country's National Health Service, government-sponsored child care, actually nationalizing the railways and the public utilities, and taxing people with high incomes to pay for these things, to go against the increases in the retirement age that the Tories planned to do, and to increase public investment. So they were going to take care of all this with taxes on high-income people, and also the increasing the tax on financial transactions, which is something that people have been fighting for. With some success in recent years in the rich countries. I haven't gotten here yet, but it's something that Bernie Sanders promoted, for example.
Mark, what can you tell us about an overview of a progressive populace contesting for power against this rising tide we've seen of right-wing and racist populace who, certainly in Europe at any rate, have based a lot of their campaign success on anti-immigrant sentiment across the continent?
Well, you know, the problem of the right-wing populism and the racist populism is really not that suddenly racism is more prevalent than it's ever been. Even in the United States, for example, Trump didn't, all his racism didn't get him a bigger share of the white vote than Romney got, or, and the two of them got less percentage of the white vote according to the exit poll data that we have. They got a lower share than the last 25 years. So what's happened is the center left has really collapsed because they've been supporting these right wing, well, these neoliberal policies, I should say, that have in the Eurozone really created mass unemployment that, you know, is going to endure for a long time unless they change their policies. And so you have these trends that allowed somebody with a real progressive populist platform to capture the imagination of the public. So you had Mélenchon in France, the left candidate, left populist there, who came within 1.3 percentage points of getting into the second round in France and in the presidential election. So I think when you have these kind of candidates, if they can break through the media barrier, they do very well. Obviously, Syriza was able to win in Greece, but they were unable to do very much because Greece is too small and they were crushed by the European authorities. We've talked about that before on your show, but that wouldn't be the case with France, and it wouldn't be the case with the UK, which is not even in the Eurozone and right now is negotiating its departure from the European Union. So I think there's a lot of hope for more of this, and I think it will have an impact on all of Europe and the developed world to see this kind of progressive politics coming back with this kind of force.
That was Mark Weisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. Find links to more analysis of the Labour Party's gains in the UK election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Some 4,000 progressive activists came to Chicago June 9th to the 11th for the second annual People's Summit Conference. The gathering, largely linked to the movement that supported independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, came to Chicago to discuss strategies to move the nation's progressive activist groups beyond resistance to building a broad people's movement for a just world. Speakers at the conference included Danny Glover, Eve Ensler, Bill McKibben, Naomi Klein, Van Jones, Linda Sarsour, Nina Turner, and of course Bernie Sanders, who gave the event's keynote address. Among the topics debated were how progressive activists and candidates should interact with the Democratic Party, that many still resent for the DNC's role attempting to marginalize Sanders during the Democratic primary campaign. The discussion about electoral politics focused on both crafting a compelling progressive policy platform and running grassroots campaigns for local office. Your reporter spoke with John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine and author, who participated as a panelist at the People's Summit. Here, Nichols talks about the potential of the progressive movement to make electoral gains and the conflicts within the Democratic Party between newly energized activists inspired by Bernie Sanders and centrists who fear a hard left agenda will alienate independent and moderate voters.
What was really striking about this couple days was the amazing diversity of folks there, economically diverse, racially diverse, ethnically, people from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of experiences. And where they came down with a remarkably shared agreement that we desperately need a new politics in America, not just to stop Donald Trump. I mean, that was a universally accepted necessity, that Donald Trump is a horrible president doing terrible damage. And, you know, nobody's got, you know, any kind of uncertainty about that. But there was also a deep, deep concern about the politics that made a Donald Trump possible and what we need to get beyond it. And I have to tell you without a question that the people who got applause, where there was, you know, where there was mention, you had an incredible burst of applause, what really struck you. There was tremendous energy and tremendous excitement as regards Jeremy Corbyn's success in rebuilding the Labour Party and pushing it forward dramatically in Great Britain last week. There was tremendous excitement about Chukwuma Lumumba, the new mayor of Jackson, Mississippi. He was there and gave an incredibly impressive speech, very powerful speech on Friday night. Christine Pellegrino, elementary school teacher who just got elected to a traditionally Republican state legislative seat in New York, in a district that voted 23% for Donald Trump. He won it very easily. This woman, who is a absolute, unapologetic progressive, took the assembly seat in a case where Democrats hadn't done it in forever. There was an excitement about the people that are coming up and winning elections and forging this next politics. So it's very exciting, I have to tell you. It was in this moment where there is so much depressing news, so much to be disappointed about, so much to be angry about, what the People's Summit really was a celebration of the possible.
As I mentioned to you before we went on the air, and many of our listeners may have seen this article, the New York Times article that came out after the People's Summit in Chicago, was very critical of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that was allied with Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign as holding back, as they termed it, mainstream centrist Democrats from winning critical elections by advocating a hard left agenda that can attract moderate, independent, and Republican voters who may be on the fence. John, I know you read that. What do you make of mainstream media like the New York Times and their analysis that the left and a left agenda, progressive agenda, just can't win elections in America?
Well, I mean, these are the same people who said that Bernie Sanders was at 2 or 3% in 2015, that he would never get any traction at all, that he would probably not even win any states except Vermont and, you know, be an asterisk for the campaign, a footnote. They got it totally wrong. He was not only stunningly successful coming from, you know, virtually nowhere. He really helped redefine the direction of the Democratic Party on a host of issues. $15 wage is now a central message of the Democratic Party. It was not that at the start of the 2016 campaign. Absolute commitments on climate change and a host of other issues. A much more militant and engaged politics. So, I mean, they got that wrong. These are the same people who told you Jeremy Corbyn was going to suffer the worst defeat ever, you know, just be totally wiped out, that the Labour Party in Britain would be destroyed by going left. Again and again, mainstream media gets the story wrong. And the reason they get it wrong, I mean, a lot of people think it's, you know, some sort of desire to dismiss the left. It's not always that. Some of these reporters for mainstream publications are really, you know, interested, engaged people who, you know, I think want to tell a decent story, but they're stuck in the past. They live in, you know, like, I don't know, 1985 or something like that. They have this fantasy that our politics will always be defined by some sort of Reagan-Mondale division. And if you're a little bit too liberal on a couple of issues, you'll scare away all kinds of voters. Well, we've pushed so far beyond that. And the reason we're pushed beyond it isn't because of politics. It's because of economic and social changes that affect politics. We're 30 years into globalization in a form that is radically changing how all of us relate to the rest of the world, what we understand, how we engage. We're 20 years into a digital revolution that is changing everything about how we communicate with one another, everything. These things are now a part of our politics. And for someone to say, oh, well, you just can't be too bold on wanting to, you know, end mass incarceration. You can't be too bold on wanting to end the drug war. You can't be too bold on saying we have to have a $15 wage. Again and again, they tell you you can't do that. They're wrong. They're fundamentally wrong. And if the Democratic Party doesn't figure this out and become a party of the 21st century instead of the 1980s, it will continue to fail.
That was John Nichols, national affairs correspondent with The Nation magazine and a contributing writer to many other progressive publications. He's the author of the forthcoming book titled
Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Find links to more commentary on the People's Summit by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. One of the many climate change fights underway since the Trump administration took office involves Trump's nominations to fill vacancies on the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. This is the government body responsible for approving all frack gas infrastructure projects that transports gas from the fracking fields of Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and other states to the rest of the country and for shipment abroad. In the past 30 years, FERC has rejected only one pipeline project. But the commission has been without a quorum since early February, and it's unable to approve new projects until Trump's nominees are approved. His first two nominees are Neil Chatterjee, a top energy aide to Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Robert Paulson, a Pennsylvania energy regulator who has labeled the many opponents of frack gas in his state jihadists. Last year, the FERC Vacancies Coalition came together to demand that no new commissioners be confirmed by the Senate until Congress conducts an investigation of FERC's ethical and legal abuses in approving energy infrastructure projects. The coalition has conducted a range of activities, including civil disobedience disruptions, at two meetings of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee that resulted in 7 arrests. One of those arrested was Lee Stewart, an organizer with Beyond Extreme Energy, one of the leading groups in the FERC Vacancies Coalition. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who volunteers with Beyond Extreme Energy, spoke with Stewart about the different elements of the campaign and his hope for the future of U.S. energy policy.
The FERC Vacancies Coalition is first and foremost demanding that our senators vote no on Trump's 2 nominations to FERC. Until the Senate holds hearings into the abuses of power and law at FERC. So, you know, we're really saying that there should be no restoration of a quorum at FERC until FERC is investigated so that that communities in the climate don't continue to be hurt, which is the course FERC will take once the quorum is restored if we don't do anything right now. What we've done is put together various actions, starting with call-in days, where we encourage members of the coalition to reach out to their members and ask them to call their senators to urge them to vote no on Trump's nominations to FERC. And then the Senate went on recess, so we put out a call to action for people to visit their senators' district offices and to meet in person with senators or their staffers to make the same demands. And we did another call-in period and several Twitter storms where we've tweeted at senators with the same demands. And all of them have been very, very successful at getting our demands and our issues with FERC out there. The Delaware Riverkeeper Network in particular has done a really excellent job at documenting the many abuses of power and law at FERC.
Lee Stewart, can you give some examples of that abuse?
So the abuses of power and law at FERC are many, but I can go over a few. First of all, in FERC's 30 or 40 years of existence, they have only rejected one pipeline infrastructure project. There's countless amounts of documentation showing how many of the projects that FERC approves are unneeded, how they're harmful to the communities that they're going through, and how they impact the climate in a very, very negative way. Another thing is the fact that FERC receives their funding from the industry they supposedly regulate, and connected to that, there's a pretty strong revolving door between FERC and the oil and gas industries, whereby people who work in FERC, including commissioners, will come from the industries into FERC And then after leaving FERC, we'll go back into the industry. So it creates this really close relationship that intertwines FERC and the oil and gas industries. According to legislation passed by Congress, FERC is supposed to be energy neutral, meaning they don't favor any form of energy over the other. They're just supposed to let the market run smoothly, I guess. But of course, their rubber stamp is favoring oil and gas industries over renewable energies. But also, this isn't an abuse, but it's something that we need to acknowledge. At this point in time, when the impacts of climate change are known, energy neutrality, which FERC is mandated to be, is completely unethical at this time. We can't be energy neutral. We have to be actively pursuing a transition off of fossil fuels. So that's something in the law that should be changed.
What's the next step for the FERC vacancies campaign?
Sometime over the next few weeks, the full Senate will vote on the candidates, and we will be, as a coalition, watching the votes very, very carefully. And one of our first steps is going to be to publicize who votes yes and who votes no, and to really hammer away at how hypocritical it's going to be if some of the senators who have recently been speaking out against Trump's decision to have the U.S. pull out of the Paris Climate Accord, to show how hypocritical it is if they vote yes on appointing a climate denier to FERC. So that's one of the immediate first steps that we're going to take. Going forward after that, I imagine that we will continue building the campaign because there will be at least one other commissioner appointment upcoming, although if Chatterjee and Paulson are approved, that will restore FERC's quorum.
That was Lee Stewart, an organizer with Beyond Extreme Energy and the FERC Vacancies campaign. For more information on the campaign, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Kerry Brittums in Tucker, Georgia, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.